Answers to all questions continue. Question 205 of 2014, the Honourable D. J. Bosino.
Can the Minister with responsibility for aviation provide details of the employment structure at the Borders and Coast Guard agencies to include the number of grades and how many are employed in each of those grades together with their duties and responsibilities?
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I will now hand the Honourable Member a statement containing the information requested.
The schedule is fairly long. It's 2 pages of rather small print. If you wish it, keeping on to our questions in our company. To talk to since it's Mr. Fitton who is asking the next question, the Honourable Mr. Bosino, you can have a look at the schedule and you should talk to it. Okay? So, we'll call questions of the Honourable Mr. Fitton.
Question 206, the Honourable D.A. Fitton.
Mr. Speaker, can the Speaker of the State whether GBC is on track to become entirely self-sufficient, which is the expectation the government expressed in 2012?
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, this remains the government's own, it is one which the current CEO shares and is working towards. We are very much on track on the planning for it.
Mr. Speaker, do the plans for making GBC entirely self-sufficient, are they still the plans that existed in 2012, or have they moved on from 2012? Has the government changed its policy? Is it just simply a continuation of what it was aiming to do in 2012?
A continuation of what was aimed for in 2012, Mr. Speaker.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, no doubt the Honourable Gentleman will recall that this question was last asked in November of 2012. And at the time, the Honourable Chief Minister said, when he was asked, well, how does he intend to make GBC entirely self-sufficient? He said, Mr. Speaker, by the profits of the joint venture it has created, namely Gibraltar Entertainment Networks Limited. If he says to his house that that project is still on course to become successful and therefore underpin GBC's entire self-sufficiency.
Yes, Mr. Speaker.
Question 200.
I'm going to go back to question 207. I'm grateful, Mr. Speaker, and I'm also grateful to the Honourable Chief Minister for the very full information he has kindly provided me in his answer. It is very much appreciated. In fact, Mr. Speaker, one of the concerns that I have that has been reported to me, and it's kind of been confirmed as a result of information that the Honourable Chief Minister has given me, is that the those who are employed as security and immigration officers are carrying out in effect the same duties as the border, let me get this right, as the borders and coast guard officers, of which there are 62 and of the former there are 15. Now, as I understand it, the security and immigration officers get paid less than the borders and coast guard officers. Maybe you can confirm whether that understanding is correct, and if it is, why is it that the security and immigration officers are doing exactly the same duties for less money than the borders and coast guard officers? But as I'm not sure about the information I've received, it may be that the premise of the question is wrong, but maybe you can confirm that. Mr. Speaker, I do not have the information on salaries here. And now that you've put that question, I'm quite happy to look into it and speak to him after the meeting at some stage in the next week or so. Speaker, maybe you're asking the same information myself, but obviously he will have the information already available than I would. I'd find out any information relating on in relation to that, I will tell the Energy Chief Minister. But I would want to encourage him to look into it. The other point I would raise, Mr. Speaker, is that in the estimate book, which was approved at the time of last budget, there was a provision for 2013-2014 of 14 security and immigration officers. Yet we have one more. Can you explain why that is? No, Mr. Speaker, I don't have the estimate book with me, but I'm quite happy to check that in the same way I'm going to take the other point of grace and have a conversation with him. Probably not today, but maybe tomorrow or next week.
Question 207, the Honourable D.A. Seaton.
Mr. Speaker, further to question number 839 of 2013, can the Chief Minister please state whether the report into the link of the tax affairs of the previous speaker has now been finalised?
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I understand that the report has not yet been finalised.
Question 208, the Honourable D.A. Beaton.
Mr. Speaker, can the Chief Minister please provide a breakdown of how many flats may be sold to the public on co-ownership and 100% ownership terms, broken down by reference to ongoing developments from outside the government?
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, all buyers in respect of the affordable homes available for sale will be given the choice to purchase between 50% and 100% share of those homes, so there is no predetermined co-ownership percentage.
Mr. Speaker, and on the basis that Mr. Secretary was saying to me is that the government will not impose, say, for example, a 20% margin of those that will be on 100% terms, 80% say co-ownership. So, given that that is the case, how will the government allocate these flats to various applicants? Bearing in mind that it's likely to be that the projects are likely to be oversubscribed. I mean, these projects are same as Waterford Terraces and Nelson's View are all oversubscribed. Can the government perhaps give me some information in relation to that?
Well, Mr. Speaker, as I've said publicly in relation to the issue, how much one can buy is not going to determine what choice a person has of which of these homes are going to be available to them. Their priority, as I said publicly at the launch of these projects, will be based on people's places on the housing waiting list. I specifically said that we did not think it was proper, we didn't think it was appropriate that under the last administration, the affordable homes were sold to those first who could afford to buy the largest share. We've taken a completely different attitude, as you now know, and your place on the housing waiting list will be what grants you the priority of choice.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, no, I understand that, and of course, he's entitled to have a different policy, and I don't criticise it. I don't criticise the policy for one moment. But bear in mind that people that are on the housing waiting list, maybe, and a lot of those people may be on the housing waiting list because they can't afford to buy. I mean, having factored that into the equation, what are the criteria for allocation when, for example, there's not sufficient take-up from people on the housing waiting list?
Well, Mr. Speaker, that is not the indication that we have from the people on the housing waiting list. At the moment it appears that we may be able to drive some people on the housing waiting list. If we're not, then there will be different classes and categories of people who may be entitled to buy those flats or the rest. The prospect bridge, if we come to it, we have ideas as to how we deal with it, but at the moment, it seems very clear to us that the people on the housing waiting list are the ones who are looking to buy. Now, obviously, somebody hasn't got the means to buy, they won't buy.
So, is the government satisfied that there is sufficient lending capacity in Gibraltar in order to ensure that people have the funding to fund their purchases for these projects?
Mr. Speaker, yes, we are, and the fact that maybe there are in some instances people don't even need to borrow. I mean, with a 2R KB starting at £27,600, which is less than the honourable gentleman's car is worth, they may be able to bear it in with one step.
This is good. Actually, Mr. Mayor, so I know what my car costs. Second hand, he does it.
But of course, it's all irrelevant. But Mr. Speaker, surely the government has taken into account in its policy in respect of these developments that there have been difficulties in the London sector. Barclays is gone now. We know that Norwich and Peterborough will also be going by the end of the year. And does the government, for example, expect to be taking some of the demand through the Gibraltar International Bank? I mean, can you give us some information in relation to that, for example?
Mr. Speaker, of course the government is satisfied that there is sufficient lending capacity. There is more lending capacity in Gibraltar at the moment than there was when the original co-ownership of states was put up for sale, and when the marvellous job that was done by the GSOP administration between 88 and 96, where 2,000 homes were developed. There were less building societies in Gibraltar, and mortgages were available to all of those people who purchased them. And Barclays has not gone, Mr. Speaker, it's not going. Barclays is going to remain in Gibraltar with a much reduced capacity. But they've already said, and the Honourable Gentleman should recall, that they're going to continue offering mortgages until 2016, which is beyond the date when mortgages are going to be required for these properties. So we're entirely satisfied that there's going to be sufficient lending capacity in the market. The position of Gibraltar International Bank is made clear by Gibraltar International Bank.
Question 209, the Honourable D.A. Seaton.
Mr. Speaker, is it increasing in a position to make an announcement in relation to those foreign investors which instead had opportunity as far back as May 2011, and which, in answer to question number 846 of 2013, he said he would be announcing towards the end of January 2014?
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, yes, sir. The recent visit to the Berlin Monitor, which was the subject of a government question, was in connection with the launch of the Gibraltar International Mint as a joint venture marketing company that will be seeking to place a new Gibraltar silver coin in the market for investment silver coins. The joint venture is with one of the numerous potential investors who have been working with the government since before our election. A specific statement on this has been agreed with the said investor, but agreeing it is slightly delayed. The launch of the new coin was planned to coincide with the 25th anniversary celebrated at the Berlin Show of the Vienna Philharmonica, one of the most successful investments of the coin. The Austrian Mint is responsible for the minting of the Philharmonica and will mint the new Gibraltar coins, and a distribution agreement has been entered into with one of the major German companies in this market. Whilst it is early days to estimate what the revenue potential is, what is clear is that there is a huge market and that even a small share of this market will provide Gibraltar with a new source of income. Other potential investors who were working with us before our elections are still in the process of finalising their investments in Gibraltar. Further statements will be made when relevant.
Thank you, Peter. I think slightly deflated. I mean, I thought that, as far back as May 2011, he made a little bit of a song and dance about the investors we had up his sleeve. I mean, in fact, it's longer than 2.5 years, to come back and to say the Gibraltar International Mint is slightly disappointing, I have to say. But, Mr. Speaker, can you perhaps give an indication what kind of contribution and you expect this will make to the economy in terms of growth of the economy? I mean, what are we talking about in terms of income to the government? Is it not in a position to provide that kind of information so we can assess the overall contribution to the economy, where that is going to be significant or it's not going to be significant?
Well, the fact is that I'm not answerable
as Chief Minister devoted for anything I said in May 2011, but I am entertaining the Honourable Gentleman's questions. And you know, I'm not going to give him an estimate today of what this business is going to be worth in the future. I mean, you'll recall that at election time, he was the one that ventured into making estimates of what results were going to be and what turnouts were going to be. And making those sorts of estimates, in my view, is a little bit foolish term not going to do that. But Mr. Speaker, new homes, a new hotel, new office development, that's real investment, Mr. Speaker, and that's what we're seeing in our economy together with a new bank. So I'm not surprised that any of the gentlemen is frustrated. Furious and frustrated.
Mr. Speaker, I have to say that if you compare the Honourable Gentleman, the government's achievements in this area and the areas that he's mentioned over the last two years, and compare it, for example, to the achievements of the first DSOC government during the same period, and there's absolutely no comparison. He's way, way behind in the achievement space, if I may say so myself. But Mr. Speaker, so just so I understand it, this is the only investment that he had in mind when he made these statements in 2011, and has made several statements to me in this past when I've asked this question over the last 2.5 years. This is the extent of the investment that he had in mind when I was asking the question, when he was answering them across the floor of his house, and also when he was making these statements 2.5 years ago. Mr. Speaker, I consider the DSOC government achievements from 1988 to 1996 to have set the standard that I would hope one day to be able to be in the shadow of. That was one of the most exciting governments that Gibraltar has ever seen, involving us with Joe Bukama leading Gibraltar's economy from a place where we were having to borrow to pay the current expenditure to standing in our own feet, putting us in a position where we could utter the word self-determination in the context of self-sufficiency at last. I know that he had family links to that government, and he is justly proud of what happened then, as I am to lead the party today, that delivered in those days what I think is, without doubt, a lesson in good and appropriate government and how to turn an economy around. So, if I am failing to achieve what Joe Bassano achieved in 1988 to 1996, I will always continue to try and emulate. I will never, Mr. Speaker, say that I turn my back on what my party did then or what it did in opposition. Something which I note is not the case in respect of members opposite, given that they're already trying to forget much of what they did when they were in government and already denying it. D-Day, the interviews given by him and his new party chairman as to the way they do things now compared to the way they used to do things before. But Mr. Speaker, if the economy grows from 1.1 billion to 1.65 billion by the time I call the next general election, even Joe Bassano would say that that was not bad. Mr. Speaker, I started the process of building 1,000 homes, half of what the GSOP built between 88 and 92, because by then already 2,000 were to be started. Well, that is at least half of what the GSOP achieved. It may not be enough, and I will always be in awe of that government, but it's so much more than the GSOP did between 1996 and 2000. Well, Mr. Speaker, I'm glad that he thinks so, because of course he actively complained against the DSOC in 1992. I'm afraid that we are, but we're here. The person who always makes against me, the deal is not in such a thing that I make against him. I have to say, Mr. Speaker, that although, because of course, he's going to come back to me, and although I wasn't supportive of the DSD prior to 2006, I hope that in the same way he'll come back to me about the 16 years of this more record of the DSD here and there, that when we talk about the positives, of which there were many in relation to the DSD, that he also gives me credit for that too, because I have taken the credit, because the net balance is heavily weighted in terms of achievement to the burdens or the unachievement of the last 16 years. But Mr. Speaker, in relation to
for this particular investment. Is there credit finance involved in any way, shape, or form? And I ask the question in the widest possible terms. In terms of any guarantees that have been provided for the investors, any assurances that have been provided by credit finance, as well as any direct or indirect financial assistance, in whatever form, and I'm trying to keep it as wide as possible for the Honourable Member, in whatever form in relation to this investment and these investments.
Mr. Speaker, in 1992, I was a student at university. And I've learned many things since then. But it's very clear, if the Honourable Gentleman goes back and looks at everything I said, that none of the criticisms I made in 1992 refer to any of the things that I have praised today, which is the economic performance of that government. Something which, even though the sound of greatest detractors, always speak highly of. So, Mr. Speaker, I don't think there's any contradiction whatsoever. But look, I think history will speak for itself and will demonstrate what it was that each of the governments that have led Gibraltar has delivered. There doesn't need to be a debate about it between us today. But we wanted to make the comparison, so I dealt with the comparison. I'm quite happy to deal with the question as widely as it is put it in relation to credit finance, Mr. Speaker. There is absolutely no involvement in respect of credit finance in the way that he has described it or otherwise, howsoever arising, in respect of this investment. But I just don't know if the director of credit finance might have bought one of these coins already. But that'd be a matter entirely for them.
Question 210, the Honourable S. M. Figueroa.
Can I just to provide details to the part of all costs incurred directly or indirectly by the government, the government and the company, and directly or indirectly in whole or in part, as a result of the enabling works at the site or assembling places and services now located at the Ocean Village Marina?
Answer the Honourable Chief Minister.
I think I will answer together with questions 211 to 223.
Question 211, the Honourable J.J. Mecklen.
Can the Minister for the Court say who paid or who has paid for the cost of the infrastructural work to accommodate the Sunburn Float Motel in Ocean Village in Harrow?
Question 212.
Mr. Speaker, can Parliament have a copy of the agreement between the government, the owners of the Sunburn and proprietors of Ocean Village with regard to the Sunburn Float Motel project, and provide the total cost of this project broken down by each entity involved?
Question 213.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for the Port state is the infrastructural work to dock the Sunburn Floating Hotel in Mason Village was a government project or a private one?
Question 214.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for the Port state who is project managing the infrastructural and dredging work in order to accommodate the Sunburn Floating Hotel in Ocean Village?
Question 215.
The Speaker, there is a letter sent to me by the Honourable Neil Costa MP on the 40th of January 2014. Can the Minister for the Port provide Parliament with the names of all the companies, including Steelmark Limited, that submitted a bid for the dredging work in order to store the contaminated material in the MV North Star and state what were their respective bids?
Question 216.
Speaker, there is a letter dated on the 14th of January 2014 from the Honourable Neil Costa MP to me. Could the Honourable Member confirm that Barando Knife and Services is still contracted by the government to remove the dredge material from Ocean Village, and if not, why not?
In 217.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for the Port say is still not limited, have been contracted by Barando Knife and Services or by the Gibraltar government in order to dredge the contaminated material in Ocean Village and place the said material in the MV North Star?
Question 218.
The figure, can the Minister for the Port, please, is some of the contaminated waste material arising from the dredging of the ocean village to accommodate the sunburn has been transferred and deposited at the Merida, Welva, rubbish dump?
Question 219.
The figure, if contaminated waste material from the dredging of the ocean village has been transferred to the Merida, Welva, rubbish dump, can the Minister for the Port say what tonnage has been deposited there and whether such material has emanated from the waste material deposited in the MV Nordster, the MV Meridian, or from subsequent dredging and delivered by lorries to Nova?
Question 220.
Speaker, can the Minister for the Port say how much tonnage of contaminated waste material from the dredging of Ocean Village has been removed to the Netherlands by using the MV Meridian, and if this ship will be further engaged for the transportation of further contaminated waste and is not run off?
Question 221.
The figure, can the Minister for the Port say is the 4,000 tons of contaminated waste material from the dredging of the Ocean Village still remains inside the MV Nordster, and if so, what is the government going to do to safely dispose of such material?
Question 222.
Speaker, can the Minister for the Port say if in the issuing of the export license to the various companies involved in the removal of the contaminated waste material from the dredging of the Ocean Village, there is an environmental audit show included to ascertain that all the contaminated waste material will be either properly treated or safely deposited and made to note, and if so, who is the competent authority to conduct the audit trail?
Question 223.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for the Port say who is paying for the removal of the contaminated material to the very final destination and how?
Answer. The Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the government notes and welcomes that the Sunborn five-star floating hotel is now permanently docked in the area between Ocean Village and Marina Bay. This is the first new hotel established in Gibraltar in many years. A number of further hotel projects have since been announced, as well as the refurbishment of existing hotels. The total cost of the infrastructure required to berth the Sunborn vessel at the said location is in the process of being calculated. This cost will not be borne by the government. The benefits of the infrastructure work have accrued to Ocean Village and Sunborn, and although government has undertaken the work as an urgent government project in order to enable this hotel project to progress, the cost will be shared by those who have taken the benefits of the project. Government is in the process of agreeing with both Ocean Village and Sunborn what proportion of the work each is liable for, and how they will respectively reimburse the government. The government is not privy to any agreement between Ocean Village and Sunborn, and cannot therefore provide details or a copy of it. There is no agreement between Sunborn and the Gibraltar government. A government of Gibraltar project manager was instructed to manage both infrastructure and dredging works appertaining to the project. A total of four companies submitted bids for the dredging work, with these being awarded to Steelmass in the sum of £680,000. The Rando Maritime Services is still contracted to remove old dredge material from Ocean Village. As far as the government is aware, no contaminated material has been transported to a rubbish dump in Nerva in Welva. Approximately 6,300 tons of dredge material was removed by the MV Meridian. It is up to the company contracted with the removal of the material to decide whether or not to engage this vessel for any further works in relation to the project. As far as the government is aware, approximately 1,300 tons still remain inside the MV Nordster out of the original quantity deposited there. This material will be disposed of by the Rwandan Maritime Services. The companies involved respectively with the collection, transportation, exportation and disposal of the contaminated waste material arising from the Ocean Village dredging are all licensed to undertake these operations. The environmental agency is the competent authority in all matters relating to the collection, storage, transportation and disposal or recovery of waste under Part 5A of the Public Health Act. The removal of the contaminated material is being paid by Buranda Maritime Services as the company contracted by Her Majesty's Government of Gibraltar to do so. The material is being transported by land.
Question 224 to the Honourable D.A. Seaton.
Mr. Speaker, can the Chief Minister state what is the value of community pension or civil service paid out by Credit Finance Company Limited as at the 31st of January 2014?
Answer the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with questions 225 to 228.
Question 225, the Honourable D.A. Seaton.
Can the Chief Minister please state what is the amount lent by Credit Finance Company Limited to the owners of the Sunbeam as at the 31st of January 2014?
Question 226.
Can the Chief Minister please state, provide details of the amount lent to the management companies of housing estates by Credit Finance Company Limited as at the 31st of January 2014?
Question 227.
Can the Chief Minister please state that at the 31st of January 2014, how much has been lent by Credit Finance Company Limited in relation to government arrears broken down by the type of arrears?
Question 228.
Can the Chief Minister please state that at the 31st of January 2014, what is the total amount loaned by Credit Finance Company Limited?
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the value of the communications paid out to government pensioners for Credit Finance Company Limited as at the 31st of January 2014 was £20,707,012. The total amount of the loan book of Credit Finance Company Limited as at the 31st of January 2014 was £46,646,565. As has already been explained in the House previously, details of individual loans issued by Credit Finance Company Limited will not be given. The details of question in question 227 remain the same as those provided in answer to question 758 of 2013 by letter of the 23rd of November 2013. I note, Mr. Speaker, that that letter is also copied to you.
Mr. Speaker, in relation to 225, which is the loan that's been provided to the funding, the Honourable Gentleman has publicly stated in an interview in the Chronicle, he said that the loan, as at July of last year, was just under £30 million. Now, if he can provide that information publicly in an interview to the Chronicle, why can't he provide it in this House when he's provided the information publicly to the Chronicle? Now, we know because he's done that, it's just under £30 million. All I'm asking is for an update of that position to be provided to this House as of the 31st of January 2014. It's not an unreasonable question, given the information that we've already provided publicly.
Mr. Speaker, it's becoming a bit tiresome to have the same debate in every meeting of the House. The Honourable Gentleman will get from me the total amount of the loan book of Credit Finance Company Limited. He will get no further breakdown. That is the position of the government. We are perfectly comfortable with giving that information. We are not comfortable giving more information because of the way that we read our obligations as lenders. Mr. Speaker, if someone has said certain things about the foreign, at the time that I gave the interview to the Chronicle, I reflected what the position was at the time. I think the Honourable Gentleman listened exactly what I said. I don't think he's reflecting it in the way that I said it. The government's position remains as it has been for the past 6 meetings of the House.
I'm afraid that I still take the view, as we do on this side of the House, that it's totally unacceptable behaviour on the part of the government. But what about in relation to 226? And the Honourable Chief Minister has accepted, in answer to past questions, that there have been loans to the management company of at least one housing estate. Now, I'm not asking for the identity of those housing estates. I'm not, which is the concern that he has publicly expressed, which is, I'm not going to breach confidentiality. We don't agree with the price, but I'm not going to breach confidentiality in revealing the identity of the people on this loan book. But I'm not even asking that. I'm asking to provide details of the total amount, not in relation to one, the total amount owed. Okay, rent to management companies of housing estates. Surely that is information that your position is entitled to ask for its information that the government should not be requisitioned and provided.
And speaker, the government has not lent any money to any housing estate that it's refusing to talk about. What we're talking about is loans by Credit Finance Company Limited, and it really is becoming time for this. Because I know that the Honourable Gentleman might have felt that he was onto a winner when he started to criticise credit finance, and he thought that he might finally be able to bring down economic hell and brimstone on the government, and this might help him to achieve his aim of becoming Chief Minister, even if it involves wrath and ruin for the people of Gibraltar. We have said what we're going to say about the loan book of credit finance. We're not going to give any breakdown of it. Now, if the Honourable Gentleman wants to know what the particular estate has borrowed from credit finance, why doesn't he call the chairman of the management company of the estate that he believes has been loaned money by credit finance and ask him? That person is likely to tell him because he's likely to have written to all the people who reside in that estate. And it's not confidential information in the hands of those individuals, but it is, in our view, confidential information in the hands of the government. That is the position. We have made it clear. It is becoming tiresome to have to repeat it. He may not like the answer, Mr. Speaker, but it's the one he's going to get. I'm just tempted to tell him to go back and read the hands of what I've already told him. Repeating the question is not going to change the answer.
Mr. Speaker, this is a different question. It's been allowed onto the order paper. It's a different question. And Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman is a master of attempting to confuse the issue. There is no confidentiality issue in relation to this. I'm not asking him to reveal the identity of the housing estate which has been lent money. I'm not asking him that. I'm asking what's the total amount that's been lent to housing estates in Gibraltar. There can't be any confidentiality in that. I can't, and I don't understand what the government reticence is. Can you explain how he justifies the extension of the government's policy, which I don't agree with, but I understand, which is confidentiality by fear. I can't reveal the identity of the people that have received loans. But now, the position he's taking now, to the court of today, which is, but I'm only going to tell you the totality of what's been lent to housing estates. And it's a remarkable lack of transparency and accountability where there ought to be accountability and transparency in this choice. That's nonsense, Mr. Speaker. It's an attempt to grab a headline which he thinks will benefit him in some way, and it really is something that the people have seen through. Look, I have said before, this is not my position now, this is the position that we have been putting since we started debating in this House. But we will not give any details of individual loans. I have said we will not give names, we will not give areas, etc. I have said that on a number of occasions. But he has got a problem with his memory, Mr. Speaker. He needs to go back and check some stuff. We have this problem in the Select Committee, where he thought I'd said one thing, but actually I've said another. When he goes back and checks the hand card, he'll hopefully come back and confirm that he's got that wrong. When he goes back and checks this, he'll also see that he got that wrong. The government is being completely transparent. We are totally see-through on this issue. But what we are not going to do is give him the details that he wants because we believe that that is confidential. I have given him, Mr. Speaker, a moment ago, the total amount of the loan book. The total. He's got it. The amount loaned by credit finance, 46 million, 646, 555. Totally transparent. Totally see-through. But he's not going to get the details of every single loan or what it's for or who it's to. It's not going to happen. And that's in our position from the beginning. What we cannot deal with, Mr. Speaker, is that we are transparent, that we are accountable, that we come here every month to answer their questions. And we answer them. But they don't like the answer, Mr. Speaker. They don't like the answer. Because they accumulated materials and failed to recover them. They promised new hotels and they failed to deliver them. They got booted up and now we are having to clear out after them, Mr. Speaker. They just can't deal with it.
All these exchanges about the loan book of Credit Finance Company Limited were already heard at the previous meeting of the House. The only difference is that the total amount is different as of the 31st of January to what it was previously, but we are going through the same arguments again.
Mr. Speaker, that is not right. That is not right. And perhaps the only difference
in respect of lack of transparency,
of course, the underlying criticism is supposed to say I will continue to do the same. The lack of transparency and accountability, which rightly we have criticized. But it's not the same. And this is the problem here, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker has been persuaded by the very simple way in which one of the Chief Minister really tries to proceed with me. I am not asking about any individual loans. I am asking the totality of the announcement being made to a particular sector. It's not even individual loans. If we're in relation to the housing sector, there may be 2, 3, 4, 5 housing estates that may have benefited. So, what's the totality? I'm actually making it easier for the Honourable Chief Minister to at least provide me with some information. That is different. Because, of course, every time that I ask a question about credit finance and the Chief Minister refuses to provide me an answer, well, I go back, I read Hansard, and I say, well, let me see whether I can get some information out of him that doesn't boost to self-imposed red lines, because at the end of the day, I'm interested in receiving as much information as possible, which is one of them. It is different. Again, I did not recognize, the Honourable Chief Minister did not recognize, that it's wrong for him to suggest that he's not providing me with information because he won't provide me information about individual loans. I'm not asking him about individual loans. It's about the totality of what's been lent to housing estates in Gibraltar. It's a particular risk, a particular sector. Now, if he won't provide me with the answer, I'm not going to pick it. Mr. Speaker, as I have said before, and if you happen to go read Hansard once again, if he actually does bother to read it, because I think sometimes he doesn't, I am giving him the totality of the loan book. The totality of the loan book. Every month he asks it, he will get it, Mr. Speaker, but he will get no breakdown of the loan book. That is the government's position. We have made our position explicit on a number of occasions. Our position has not changed. And he's just trying to see how he can perhaps get more information. But look, if he wants to continue trying to get more information, he can do what he likes. But our position is clear, transparent, and see-through. The total amount of the loan book, every month, set out in answers to questions. Absolutely nothing wrong with that, Mr. Speaker. It's the appropriate way to act. It's the way that the government is advised is the appropriate way to act. But, Mr. Speaker, I will at least take from him that he considers me very skillful and masterful. He doesn't often call me the things that I might like to remember, Mr. Speaker. I'll take at least that from today's session of the House.
Question 195. The Honourable D. J. Bethune.
So this is question number 676 of 2013. Can the Minister for Employment state whether any new companies are benefiting from the government's policy on business startups and investments?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Enterprise, Training, Employment and Health and Safety.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with question 188.
Question 188.
Can the Minister for Employment provide details of the government's business startup policy?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Enterprise, Training, Employment and Health and Safety.
Mr. Speaker, the position continues to be a state of an answer to question 676 of 2013. The government policy on new startups is to provide assistance and advice that may be required by the individual engaged in wanting to set up a new business.
Mr. Speaker, the policy is wider than that. To get around it, I don't have a copy of the chronicle article which reported on, I think the answer that he is the carpenter provider in relation to different startups. So it's actually more particular than that, albeit confusing. So the first question is as I put it. In relation to question, the first question I asked is 185. Does he have an explanation as to why no more companies are benefiting from this particular scheme?
Well, I can make an educated guess. If the Honourable Member remembers, I told him that when the initiative was taken by the department, it was identifying a group of people who had been unemployed for some time and who were in their late 50s and who were therefore finding difficulty in obtaining alternative employment, particularly in the construction industry. And that, given that they were competing with people younger than them and coming over the frontier. And therefore, there were a number of companies where the department took the initiative of approaching the individuals and suggesting to them that given the difficulties that they were having in finding work and that we were having in getting employers to take them on, that they might consider the possibility of using their accumulated skills in the industry, people have been maybe 20 or 30 years in the industry, and with our help set up a business. Those were the first ones that were set up, and they were set up because we encouraged them. We went out to suggest it to people. And most of the people in that category were accommodated and have now got these little companies that are doing very well, and they've taken on trainees, and the owners are working owners, that is, they own the company, but they actually use the tools themselves, and they help to train young people with them, and they've then taken them on. So that's worked very well. But of course, this is always a limited market. In that category, there might have been 7 or 8 people, that is all. So that, in my view, is the reason why that particular type of startup, was exhausted if tomorrow we find somebody, for example, where he's laid off and fit the characteristics that I want, and we find we're having a difficulty in getting them a job with somebody else, then we would again repeat that exercise. But at the moment, there are no potential candidates that have been identified by us. In a few instances, not many, the initiative has been the approach from an investor who then needed a different kind of help. The help might have been, how do I go about putting together, for example, a proposal in order to get EU funding for the project that I want to do? Or, how much help can you give me in training people for what is a specialist task? So there are effectively two basic sources. One source is the one that, in effect, we created ourselves, and the other is, of course, that comes, if you like, spontaneously out of people who decide to invest their own money and set up a little business. And that, is the one where the widely defined part of the answer is because the advice and the help that we give is driven by the demand for the advice and the help, as you said. The latter category is probably don't need any help to setting up a company, and they already have a company. But then they need help with identifying how can they put a package together which is likely to succeed in getting them EU funding, given that there are criteria as to which industries qualify and which don't, and how many jobs need to be created, and the fact that those who are in government will know that there are certain EU funds that can only be used to support people who've been a long time out of work or of a certain age. So all that kind of help and advice is provided to the people who come looking for us, and the advice that they get depends on the process of us.
Because all of that, which is much more like the detail of the policy, as a result of the negotiations which the Honourable Chief Minister told me on a few previous sessions in his house, when he said that, again, I don't have the copy of Hanford in front of me, but when he suggested that the detail of the policy, and he knows that the government has been a subject of criticism from us in relation to, its apparent resistance in revealing to us what the detail of the policy is or was, that the Honourable Chief Minister would be entering into negotiations with the GSSB and the Chamber of Commerce. So, what the Minister for Employment just told me a result and the fruit of the negotiations and the discussions that the Chief Minister had with the GFSB. I think he mentioned singled out the GFSB and didn't mention the Chamber of Commerce. Is that the case? Is my understanding the case? And if I may, Mr. Speaker, just because I think it's connected as a sort of a supplementary, the Honourable Chief Minister also told me in a previous session that the detail of the policy was available at the ECB. And is that a document that can be obtained from the Honourable the Minister for Employment's office? Because it seems that it is the Honourable Minister for Employment as opposed to the Honourable Minister for Commercial Affairs who had in charge of this particular scheme.
That the recipients of the help and advice the two categories that I've mentioned in terms of local businesses, and obviously also the people that I see who are looking at the possibility of investing in developers. So, your honourable member got a letter from me telling him a number of people that I was seeing in different areas about potential investment some time ago. So, for example, those people would be a new type of business as well. I mean, you know, somebody comes and says, I want to set up a factory here to do A, B, and C. It's a type of business, but it's not local type of business. In those cases, then the people have got to be given more information about more things which they don't know. Of course, quite often, people who come in with investment ideas have an initial meeting with me as a minister responsible for inward investment, and then the matter is followed up because they have accountants or lawyers here to look after their interests when they're not here. So these people don't normally spend all the time here. But the basic approach of the department is not that we have a sheet of paper that says all the things that you do, other than the ones that were there already under the giving back office, which were leaflets that said, if you want to incorporate a company, you do all these things and you go and then become a fund of lawyers and a fund of accountants. All that material was already there in 2011 and it's still there today, right? And that is predominantly for people who come in from the outside. From the people who are already established in the boat or who may be moving from employment to self-employment, then the answer is that they sit down with somebody in the employment service who finds out what it is that they require and helps them to achieve it and get them in touch with people. Where people have got sufficient capital to do all this on their own and get professional advice, they don't come to us for help. Where they come for us to help, frankly, the interest that we have is that we want people to be able to set up employment opportunities, and therefore if the employment service has got a vested interest in helping a potential employer to get on its feet and open vacancies. If you can do that.
Yes. Mr. Speaker, can you confirm this? You will recall that when you raised this about this company, we called ECB One Limited, ECB One Limited, and then the subject of a change of name. You will recall that that's when we found out that, in fact, what was being provided by the government was, a registered office, almost corporate service provider facility, the registered office, directorship, shareholders by government, by government employees. And as a result of us revealing the existence of this company, we found out, one, that there were more, and two, we found out that this was a service which was apparently being provided by the government, although no announcement had been made in relation to that. So can I ask you to confirm that this service is being provided as part of this scheme? In other words, that the government will provide for those people who are wanting to set up a business in Gibraltar as part of it, and I can read it, the business startup and marketing manifesto commitment, will be providing corporate service facilities for a limited period of time, and then they go off to another corporate service provider if they find one.
Answer that. But, I mean, he doesn't have to go back and look at Hunter. We have to remember what I said to him 10 minutes ago. I told him that the work that had been done on the initiative of the department, where we had set up the company, provided them with the directors, done everything that could be done, where for people long-term unemployed, in their 50s, in the construction industry, all of whom now are operating very successfully, providing services in the construction industry, predominantly as subcontractors, have taken on trainees, have now taken on their payroll those trainees full-time, and you know, and have created employment and activity, and therefore we've removed both the employer and the employee from the unemployment list. And that is where the level of support that had to be given was very, very high. And I told him that the service that is there, and I told him that although we appear to have used up the pool of 8 or 9 people that met that characteristic, that if tomorrow somebody loses their job, is in his 50s, or is finding great difficulty in getting another job, we have great difficulty in getting an employer to take him, all the experiences that I've already given him. Then it will trigger again what we did already in the first batch of people, and we will then use our offices, set the company up, provide them with the directors, and then when it's all up and running, pass it over to him. The people that come to us on their initiative don't need that kind of help. They've already got a business, or they already know enough about having a business to be able to do a lot of this stuff for themselves, and they've got the money, which people who are living on social assistance did not have, to pay a lawyer or an accountant. So there is nothing mysterious about this. It's a service that is there to meet a need which was not being met. The need was a very limited one in terms of numbers. There are not hundreds of people in this category. If there were more tomorrow, the service would be reactivated tomorrow. We ourselves monitor the unemployment list regularly, and we monitor where we think there are potential candidates for the provision of the service. Of course, we have approached people who said they're not interested as well. I mean, you know, the offer has been made to some people who have not wanted to take it up. They have said they don't want to get involved. They don't feel confident in you know, having the responsibility of having, I mean, once they get up and running, the companies, for example, that were created in the first year, and now in the second year, they now have the responsibility of dealing with the tax and dealing with social insurance and dealing with all those things, and not everybody can cope with that. So there are people that we've offered the service to and have said no. All the people that said yes, we've done it for them. We haven't got, at the moment, anybody else that identified that as a potential candidate, but that could change tomorrow. But in addition to that, the service that is provided by the department, both to incoming investors and to local businessmen, and the service that I am doing, and other people may be doing other things, is based on what did invest had initially, which was also for local and outsiders, which was really a series of leaflets of where do you go to get what you need, but we go one step further in, you know, getting things arranged for them if they need our help. And really, the people that need our help are the people who are entering into a field that they've never done before. You've got somebody who already got some business activity, some business experience, they need very little from us. But we are there to help whoever approaches us because it's in our interest, as I said, as an employment service, to help businesses expand and take on more workers. Okay? And that is what the rationale of this is all about.
Speaker, I mean, as I understand what you mean is that what you said is, this is a scheme open to the unemployed. So the unemployed were provided with help in setting up a company. They were provided with help in terms of directorship services, shareholder services, with civil servants acting as directors and shareholders, with the ETB, with the town range address and number 6 place being used as a registered address. And then they would be given a government contract, they would obviously earn an income as a consequence of that, and they would then employ trainees from the future job strategy, which they would then train within this company.
that, as I understand, is what he has said. In relation to the 15 companies that were initially set up in this particular way, I think it's 15. Were all these unemployed from the unemployment list?
Every single one of the companies that were set up was the company from the unemployment list, what is said.
Including the owner of ETB1, I'm not going to mention his name across the floor as well, but the Honourable Gentleman knows who he is.
Oh, I don't know who he is. I don't know who the owner of ETB1 is. It sounds as if it was from a science fiction serial, actually.
No, not a science fiction. Maybe a nightmare for the government, but not a science fiction. I'm talking about Mr. Lewis Edwards, who's the owner of this particular company, ETB1. I mean, was he part of the unemployment list? Is he unemployed?
I have already said that every single person that was helped to set up a company was at the time unemployed. I mean, is the honorable member saying I am lying? Well, then the answer is, if you ask me three times, if the people were helped were unemployed, and I tell him yes, and now mention one individual, it doesn't matter whether the guy called Edward or Susan. If Susan was unemployed, he would get helped.
Of course, there is a difference between somebody being unemployed and registered unemployed with the ETB. Can you also confirm that we're all registered unemployed with the ETB, or were they just simply unemployed because they didn't have a job at that particular moment in time, or were they registered unemployed with the ETB? And in particular, were they long-term unemployed? I mean, I can understand perhaps the logic. Well, I can understand perhaps some logic in doing something like this for the. Provided that they are sufficiently skilled to pass the skills on to other people, long-term unemployed. But can you confirm that we're all registered unemployed?
Well, I don't know whether the honourable member is familiar from the first time he spent in government as to how the system works. But he must know that there are people who are unemployed and who, in between periods of being registered, are up. So the people who are unemployed appear and disappear periodically from the employment register at the rate of about 100 a month. Whether in the particular month that the particular individual was actually helped in setting up a company, he happened to be in the last category or in the employment category, I don't know.
Yes, of course, Mr. Speaker, let me give you another example. I could resign from Hassan tomorrow and say, well, now I'm unemployed. Can I have a company? I wouldn't actually say that something like that had been designed to get an opportunity from the government.
He answered that question. He said that if he was unemployed, he would get the. He answered that question.
Hasn't understood the point that I'm making. You see, Mr. Speaker, this question of he has to be unemployed before he benefits, that's a loophole. Because you can say to somebody, resign from your job tomorrow, I'm going to give you a company. Resign tomorrow, and he's unemployed. Now, that's why I've asked, and I've spoken to draw the distinction between that and somebody who is registered unemployed and long-term unemployed, in particular at the ETB. Now, can you perhaps provide some information in relation to that?
Well, Mr. Speaker, if it's a massive loophole, then that massive loophole would be generating a queue of applicants. And I just told the honourable member that because there were 17, I said there were 8 or 9, and I just told the honourable member that as far as we are concerned, that the department goes looking for people that we have difficulty in employing in order to see if by helping them to become self-employed, it is possible to make them economically active. or is it that the opposition for reasons that are incomprehensible to me appears to see people argue on social assistance, unemployed, relying productively employed, generating wealth, and bringing an income to their family? I mean, I cannot understand how anybody can be critical unless it is that if you've got a particular name or have got a particular view, then it shouldn't apply to you. Because it seems to me that what the honorable member is telling you that it depends who you are, whether you get help or not. And I can assure him that if you've got anybody who is a supporter of his or a member of the GOP who falls into the parameters that I have described, I would be delighted to help that person.
Well, Mr. Speaker, thank you very much, the Honourable Minister, for that answer. But you see, the concern from this side, or one of the concerns from this side of the House, is that for a government that really delights, because it really does delight, in ticking boxes and making announcements, I mean, one announcement that it was continuing paying grants to students. That's one manifesto commitment to it. Why did the government not make an announcement about this particular scheme at the very beginning when it was when it started it? And we only found out because it appears to us that the opposition rumbled them with this particular scheme when it did when it made public the fact there were a series of companies ready for number 6 Common Place and at the and Town Rail where direct assistance and shareholder service will be provided by civil servants.
Well, I don't know what grumbling means, Mr. Speaker, but what presumably he means is that he went to the company's register and looked at the company's register and found the register on there. If looking things up in the company's register is grumbling, I suppose he knows about that because he's a lawyer, he knows a lot of grumbling all the time as part of his livelihood. All I can tell him is what I told him. We didn't make an announcement because we launched the scheme by identifying potential candidates. The scheme is open to people without having to wait for an initiative from us. The people that approach us generally are not the people in the category that I have described because it is something that doesn't even occur to them. The ones that have done it and are successful and are now providing a service to the government and to the construction industry, many of those small subcontractors are now working for the bigger construction companies as subcontractors, and therefore that is reflected in people who are not being paid by the government, who are being paid for doing work. But it means that the number of people taken in the construction industry was the highest since 1996, when the last survey was published, and will be higher again, and will keep on getting higher. Because we keep on training more people, and then we stop paying them, and then we start paying their keep. Now, it's a policy that they can criticize or they cannot criticize. It's a matter for them. All I can tell the honorable member that it is producing the results, which in the debate that I had with him initially, he said it would be difficult to achieve, but we are assisted, he would be happy to see more Gibraltarians working, but he doesn't seem to be happy. He seems to be unhappy. Because he wants to criticize me for achieving what he thought would be difficult, and I can tell him it's not that I am satisfied that we've accepted what we can do. I think we can do more, and we will be doing more. But so far, what the Honourable Member is asking me in his original question is, what is the state of play at the moment? Well, look, the state of play at the moment is not what New York would have the best of his money. The state of play at the moment is what is happening with the policy. With the policy, what is happening is that the people we have identified we've actually put on the road to earning a living, and that if tomorrow we identify more, we will do it. And if there are people that we've missed out and they know of, we'll be happy to help them. And if there are people who are on their own initiative, come forward and say, well, look, I want to set up this business. Is there a way in which you can help me? We will listen to them. I haven't announced it publicly. Well, look, everything I am saying to him here is public.
Question 186, the Honourable D.J. Bacino.
Can the Minister for Employment provide details such as the grade and duties of the person who is providing the liaison service between the gaming industry and the employment service as recently announced by the Minister for Financial Services?
I say the Honourable Minister for Enterprise, Training, Employment and Health and Safety.
Speaker, the grade of the person involved in providing a liaison service between the gaming industry and the employment service is that of a GDCHEO. The duties of the post in respect of the employment service are predominantly driven by ensuring a rapid response to the requirements of the industry, particularly in respect of the need to rely on non-EU nationals who require work permits, given the nature of the client base of this industry. The need for the creation of the liaison service was identified following representations by the industry about delays which affected their ability to recruit specialist staff, especially where non-EU nationals were concerned. Following this initial step, the role has been widened to include other aspects, for example, liaison with different companies in respect of the current situation where some sections of the industry are requiring additional personnel, whilst others are currently reducing their money levels. As much of the work involved in employment service, the Office of Concern also undertakes a similar role in terms of expediting responses from other government departments to the requirements of the industry. The feedback that has been received is that this liaison service is greatly appreciated by companies operating in the sector.
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Minister will know that this is an announcement made by the Honourable Minister of Financial Services in the course of a debate that he and I participated in GDC about 2 weeks ago. And he knows that I work on it now as something that really facilitates the service which has been provided for such an important part of Gibraltar's economy. But the first question I would ask is one of detail. He says that this person has an HBO position. Would that be a great I think it is under the GDC. We just confirm that. Grade 4. And secondly, the question which I have is why is it possible, certainly in relation to the initial duties that this person is carrying out, which is more relevant to the duties that maybe more properly ought to have been carried out by the employment service? Why is it that the employment service doesn't have a sufficient either in numbers or in qualified staff, or perhaps even in experienced staff, to be able to provide the service in-house? Was it necessary to appoint this person to act as a liaison between the industry and the service?
Well, the person was selected, in fact, because the person was at the preceding moment in the employment service of the request. And effectively what happened was that it was transferred from the employment service to the department responsible for government, so that in fact, instead of each individual company approaching the employment service with a problem, they have somebody that is permanently working there to do that for them. So, you know, it's a way of providing a channel. The request to have been in the employment service, but instead of us having a person in the employment service who has a job to do, which involves providing a receiving point from the gaming and the banking and the construction and everybody else, the people in the employment service are not broken into dedicated categories of employers. They deal with all employers irrespective of where the request comes from. Because the system that was in place when it was being done by the employment service was not given the priority to gaming in respect of our customers, so it was first come, first served. The gaming was making representations to us, then in response to that lobbying, if you like, I suggested, well, look, we will take the employee we've got here and transfer them to the department that is responsible directly for the gaming, and now instead of each head of department coming to my department looking for assistance with something, everything goes to that person that is there already, and that person then makes sure that it gets to the right person in the employment service, having been there and having been at the other end of the business. So the reason is because effectively, what the MMO member is suggesting as an alternative, it was used to happen, which is what they thought was not being sufficiently rapid in providing responses. When they changed it, it produced a better result.
Mr. Speaker, given the obvious positive experience of this venture, presumably, there's no reason why it can't be extended to other industries, like, for example, the insurance industry. And, the question related to specifically to the gaming industry, if it's already been provided to other industries within the financial services world, then I would ask the Honourable Minister to confirm that position.
Well, I think the Honourable Member should realise one thing that is peculiar to the gaming industry, and that is, first of all, it's bigger than the others. There are 3,000 employees. Secondly, it's more diverse in terms of nationality, but it has more people in it out of the 3,000 that require visas and permits and other things that most of the others don't. And it has a much higher turnover. I mean, the turnover in the industry, for example, I think I gave him the figures at one stage, or if I didn't give it to him, I gave it maybe to somebody else in the position. But when we look at the trend, we found at one stage, about a year ago, that although there were at one point in time 3,000 people, there had been actually 9,000 people in the space of about 18 months who had come into the industry and 6,000 who had left. So, you know, in almost every month, well, even more than that, in almost every day, there is a state of termination and commencement. And in another, there is likely to be a turnover of 60 or 70 jobs in the gaming. That kind of turnover does not exist in other areas where there is more long-term stability. And therefore, although there may be other facing similar problems, they are not of an equal magnitude that it can make a difference if there is somebody permanently dealing with them and specializing and becoming familiar. And something, for example, I can tell the Honourable Member, for example, this particular officer is dealing also with banks, because we had a situation a week ago where, in terms of the touch workers, one of the things that we put, one of the mechanisms we put in, because of the requirement that the detached worker requires an 11A form from the country of origin, it's going to produce evidence that they're paying social insurance in the country of origin. All those mechanisms which are required by EU law meant that sometimes somebody was going to be brought in to look, for example, at the IT system, and the time they were over here was taken up more in processing that their application met EU requirements. So we've now introduced a fast-track system for people who will be here 2 weeks or less. Well, there was an instance a week ago where the individual that was going to be here was going to be 1 day over 2 weeks. If that had gone through the normal bureaucratic channels, it would have eventually reached a point where somebody would have said, it got over 2 weeks, the answer is no. Because we have somebody there that was able to pick it up early on, and they phoned him and they said, look, although the criteria is 2 weeks, this person is going to be there 1 day over the 2 weeks. Can we be flexible and approve the faster system? And the answer was yes. So, and this is for a bank and not a gaming company. So that gives you a moment of flavor of the kind of which, on a day-to-day basis, you can make that a little bit easier for the people that you want to stay here and make them feel welcome.
Question 187, the Honourable DJ Bassini.
Can the Minister for Employment state the number of people that are currently employed in the public and private sectors respectively?
I'll answer the Honourable Minister for Enterprise, Training, Employment and Health and Safety.
Mr. Speaker, I said that for the 1st of December 2013, according to the Office of the Employment Service, the number of persons employed in the public service was 6,393, and in the private sector, 19,707, excluding directors and self-employed.
Question 189, the Honourable D.J. Bassini.
Can the Minister for Employment provide an update on the recruitment process in relation to the Sunborne Floating Hotel?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Enterprise, Training, Employment and Health and Safety.
There has been a constant close cooperation between the Employment Service and Sunborne regarding its labour requirements. And the first vacancies were opened in June 2014, meetings were held in July, in August the 5th, and 14th and 21st, in September the 5th, the 17th, 20th and 23rd, in October the 3rd, 11th, 25th, 29th and 30th, in November the 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, 9th, 21st and 22nd, in December 6th, 11th, 13th, 17th and 19th, in January 13th and 15th, 20th and 22nd, 28th and 29th and 30th, and in February of the 14th. As a result of all these meetings, a number of the vacancies have been identified and candidates provided from the local workforce, either with the required skills or with the potential for training.
Mr. Speaker, do you remember able to give me a number of positions filled? Because I have here an article which appeared again in the Chronicle on the 22nd of August, where Mr. Steendale, who is the CEO for the funding, said that he was working with Joanna Hernandez and the team at ECB to fill 200 positions and an additional 20 positions for senior roles. And then he said, in commenting why all the 200 jobs have been placed with ECB, he said that the jurisdiction has been good to Sunborn and Sunborn wants to be good to the jurisdiction. Now, there was then a fellow article of the 7th of February 2014, where he mentions another figure of 100, 50% less. Can you give me some detail in relation to numbers, please?
Well, I think the first caveat is that you shouldn't believe everything you read in the press. And I think the second is that I think there is a certain amount of poetic license in his numbers. There aren't all that many people already working. There are quite a number of people that have been identified as suitable, and contracts have been entered into, but with a starting date that hasn't yet been triggered. But I would be very happy if we were able to take 10 to 15% of the jobs, because in fact we do not have, among the unemployed, a large number of people with previous experience of working in hotels. In fact, we have very few people working in hotels as it is. I mean, if one looks at the actual existing hotels, the bulk of the devotarians are doing office work, and there are very few
that is the one exception of the of as a brother. But the brother is not an industry that has ever been very attractive, because it's an industry that you have to work where you have to go to the top. That's the reality. You know, you start at the bottom, you learn every get in the hotel, and eventually when you get to the top, you know everything that is going on in the whole outfit. But that, of course, is not something that you can take into a hotel. I mean, there will be people, hopefully, who are now coming in as trainees into this hotel, which will follow that path. And I think that if we have more hotels, there will be a critical mass in this industry for us to be able to say, well, look, we can now invest maybe in a school which will provide staff for 5 or 6 or 7 hotels. But with the number of jobs that there are at present, I think many of the jobs that require experience and qualified people will go outside. What we are trying to do is to persuade the Sanborn to take as many of the people that have got qualifications in other areas which are willing to put profession. You know, we're making the poor graduates available to them for the areas that they can be trained. We've got a few people that have got background in working as cooks and waiters and that kind of thing, which are also supplying. But at the stage where we are now, I think we've got something like a dozen people that we've identified that are already there in. And there are an awful lot of people that have put their CVs in from outside, that the company gave us an undertaking right at the beginning, that they would work closely with us and express every possibility here before they took anybody from outside. And even when they take people from outside, they've got people from Scandinavia, where, you know, they've got their own people made from the parent company. But even when they take people from outside, we shall be trying, as far as it is economically reasonable, to have people additionally to the normal complement, to give people the opportunity to learn the skills. But we're at the stage of the process. All I can say is, it's obvious from the long list of meetings that are being held between my staff and the company that there's been very close involvement at every stage.
Because I just want to assess results and what the Honourable Minister is planning to do in terms of numbers. He mentioned, and he said 10 to 12% as probably the realistic number he's likely to secure from the Gumball in terms of employing the locals. He then mentioned he gave an absolute figure of 12. As I understand, that's the current figure. But can he give me an absolute figure that he would like to see? He would like to see employed at the Sanborn. The Chronicle report, 200 foundation jobs being placed at the ECD. I'm not sure what Mr. Stephen there was referring to by foundation jobs. It's in the comments. But what figure does he think he's realistically unlikely to be able to achieve?
Exactly to think, what would I like? I would like everybody except the owner to be from the unemployment list. But that's not going to happen. I think realistically, given the nature of the skills that they require, which we've got a very detailed breakdown of, and the pool of available registered unemployed that we have, which is about 400, of which out of that 400, there might have been, I don't know, 20 or 30 from the hotel and catering industry, you know, and most of those people are people who are the ones who are experienced are people in their 50s or 60s, and I mean the Moroccan. The younger people are people that are keen to go in but have had very little experience. So I can tell you, honorable member, that I don't want to put myself in the foot by putting a figure that anybody else is going to try and hold me to if we can get more. Okay? The realistic figure is that if we manage to 15% of the workforce, or whatever the workforce is, it's 100 or 200 or 300, well, I don't know. I mean, I don't manage the company has opened a large number of vacancies, but look, in a hotel, this is not, I mean, when you're running a hotel, it is not the same thing as running something where you have to have a fixed pool of people. In a situation like this, where the hotel is opening itself for the first time, they may find, once they start operating, that they need a smaller pool of people for certain activities, and that they need to take people extra people in, like all hotels do when they are full to capacity. So, but in any event, I mean, we would expect all the admin staff to be ours, because there doesn't have to be a specialist catering establishment too. The people who do the payroll, the people who do the office work, all those people we can supply. The people with catering skills and hotel skills and hotel experience are already working. There may be people who live at a hotel and wait for this one. You know? I mean, recruiting from the local labor market is not limited to recruiting from the people who are unemployed. There's nothing to stop the company if they cannot find it from what we have got available, from looking at some of the people who may be working for existing hotels and who've applied to go to this one because they might think it's a better future or more money or better promotion opportunity. You know? But at the end of the day, at this point in time, we are not, we've done a lot of preparatory work, but we are not to the point where I can say, well, look, the hotel is going to have 200 people working in a month's time. That I'm not able to say. If it were there, and if it opened in a month's time, and if there were 200 people, and out of those 200, we had 30 or 50, then I would say we've done well.
Mr. Speaker, is the Honourable Minister able to, he may not have this information available with him now, but is he able to tell his house now how many vacancies have in fact been opened? You've heard me make reference to the press reports. And in fact, reading it again whilst he was providing his answer, basically what I want to do is establish whether what is being said in the press by the company is in fact the real situation. Because, you know, the company is saying, as the reporter has said, that by the time the hotel opens on March the 1st, there should be a staff complement of around 100 operational staff in both full-time and part-time positions. And then apparently the company goes on, it does not give specific numbers, but said many of its workers have come from the unemployment list. Now, what I would like the minister who has responsibility for this, for employment, is to be able to tell this parliament what in fact the position is really going to be.
Well, I can say to the Honourable Member, when the first announcement was made and before the first vacancy was opened, when there were queues going in circles around Ocean Village, the total number of cities had been was 2,951, of which 350 were from Gibraltarians, of which perhaps 50 were unemployed. The number of vacancies that are present on our books, I cannot tell him, but I doubt that there are 200 vacancies. But we have provided in the period 350 names from people unemployed. But of course, I told you and I don't remember how long this has been going on. You need to understand that the fact that, for example, we submitted potential candidates way back in August, doesn't mean that those potential candidates have been waiting patiently and employed, refusing every other job, waiting for the sandbox to open its doors. So, you know, much of the long list of people we've employed, we've submitted, may, when the time comes and the sandbox says, I'm ready to employ you, may no longer be interested because they found something like this. So, you know, these are the figures that are best, the ones that are shared with him, but I do not think that there are 200 jobs open.
Mr. Speaker, I'll ask a specific question as the next session of Parliament in relation to the figures, so therefore the Honourable Member will be able to come prepared with the replies. I think it's information which the public ought to have. The other further supplement I have, Mr. Speaker, is I'm not sure whether he's dealt with this in any specific way in his first reply. How many, if any,
Speaker job strategy trainees have been taken on to replace them with the funding.
Another moment.
Mr. Speaker, is there any reason for that? Because obviously this is precisely because of the experience and training deficiency which is identified in the hotel industry. I mean, I come from a family who, you know, is involved in a particular industry. It is something I personally would like to see more of the hotels doing, given the fact that more hotels are now going to be opened, hopefully shortly, in Gibraltar. Does that not present an opportunity, given that we have Ms. Sanborn here with us now, to ensure that our local population is trained in this field?
Well, the policy, as the Honourable Member knows, even though he doesn't believe it, is that we provide trainees with a job guarantee at the end. We're not, you know, I mean, we run some training courses without jobs. But others, so if you believe that, then you must believe that people have got real jobs and not that it's a son with better jobs. Which is what you get. So the answer is that when the someone is able to sit down with us and do a program for training, which will lead to maybe replacing some of the people that they have, because the training would probably take more than just the short-term training that is now taking place, then if there are suitable candidates and people interested, we will be happy to provide the trainees and finance them.
I'm not responsible for the previous AACR government, but I am willing to tell the Honourable Member behind the Speaker's chair what the results were of a hotel and apprenticeship scheme which the United Kingdom Separator introduced. Question 190, the Honourable E.J. Hurry.
If the Speaker says, can government provide details in respect to the number of employees who may have been employed since the answer provided to question number 98 of 2014 by Leisure Construction and Maintenance Company Limited, broken down by grade, age, gender, and nationality?
I'll give the Honourable Minister for Enterprise, Training, Employment and Health and Safety.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with question 191.
Can government provide details in respect of the directors of Leisure Construction and Maintenance Company Limited?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Enterprise, Training, Employment and Health and Safety.
Mr. Speaker, prior to question 98, the answer is none. The Employment Service has no record in respect of any registered directors of this company.
Mr. Speaker, may I just clarify, the Employment Service may have no record of directors, but given that this company is a government-owned company, wearing that hat, can any Minister of the Government say who the directors are, please?
Speaker, he may give what is directly what he wants to be given, but if the question is that he's asking for me to provide the details of the directors, and I'm telling him there are no directors registered with this company in BTB, and no employees, I think that it must follow if it has no trade license. If there are no directors here, there are no employees, it must follow that it is not doing anything.
We spent half an hour this morning on this.
I have to say, who drew the license application if we have no directors in the police?
Yes, and what is happening, the Chief Minister has given me another supplementary to ask, I mean, who made the application? They made no application, and there's no employees.
Mr. Speaker, the company that registered with the ETB did not register anybody working for it as a director or as an employee. And we now learn that if it ever applied for a trade license, which apparently did, it did not proceed with the application.
So, Mr. Speaker, is it a government held company or isn't it a government held company?
It is not a government owned company. I think the Honourable Member was told that when the matter was first raised by him.
And Mr. Speaker, no, I was not told that we're not a government owned company. When the matter was first raised, I was passed into a company's house for which I had to pay a fee and conduct the search.
And I found out that the company registered on the 11th of February 2013 with a registered office of 31 in Town Green, and there are two public servants as shares of private. And I said, Mr. Speaker, that's nothing else has been told to us about. All I know is, from the minister, this is really for sport and leisure, that two employees, I believe, from his ministry are the ones who actually signed the application for the trade license for this. And in all serious answers, the company has no direct employees at that. So I understand from all the ministers and some of the servants have been saying that these public servants helped in the administration and the setup of the company and so on. But we haven't got to the mitigating now of the latest supplementary by the legal decision of, you know, from the record, this seems to be a government owned company, and there are no directors, no employees, and not even an interest to pursue a trade license anymore. So, you know, why do we have existence of this company, which originally was going to sell itself as trading from chemicals in the port of Portland as authority? Well, what the Honourable Member has described is a situation in which there was something that happened at one point in time and nothing has happened since.
Mr. Speaker, is this then one of those companies that the Honourable Gentleman was answering questions about earlier on, which is the startup scheme, where he says that people from the unemployment list or unemployed people were assisting in incorporating a company with public service directors and shareholders in order to then be provided with government contracts in whatever sector to then recruit trainees from the pieces of strategy. Is it one of those companies then?
Or it isn't?
You see that? I don't want to go around in circles. You must know what this company is about. You had a company, it's registered at Town Green, it's the offices of the Honourable Gentleman. And he knows exactly what is happening in his office. It has public servants as shareholders of the company, and it applies for a trade license in the circumstances that the Honourable Gentleman, Mr. Reyes, has indicated. And he must know more about this company. Say what type of a company it is, because if it's not one of those startup companies, and it's not a government-owned company. I mean, what are public servants doing as shareholders of this company, and what is it doing being registered at Town Green?
No, it's not one of the companies, because those are the people that he's mentioning are not long-term unemployed contracted workers in the city. So therefore, that's how it is that it is not one of those companies. The fact that some people said that the company then, and nothing else has happened since, it's because whatever it is that might have happened didn't happen, and therefore there is no license, there is no activity, there are no shareholders, and there are no directors and no employees. And as far as I'm aware, there is no company anymore. But Mr. Speaker,
it's a company that's registered as his offices. It's registered in his offices with civil servants working for him as shareholders. But what is this company incorporated to do?
What was its purpose?
I think the honourable man by saying that it is registered on the sense, in the sense that it was registered originally there. I think you will find that it's no longer registered anywhere and that the company no longer exists.
All right, Mr. Speaker, so the company no longer exists. The fact is that it was registered at Town Lane's representative with his civil service as shareholders. He must have been involved as the minister in giving the go-ahead to its incorporation and its register in his offices. I didn't expect civil servants to go on a frolic of their own and incorporate companies and register them as his office. I mean, that's not the kind of thing that that I would expect that would happen. Therefore, he must have some knowledge as to what the company is about. Can you explain what was the purpose of this company? He's now said that no longer is before. What was the initial purpose of this company? It's incorporation registration that his office is.
I haven't checked that out, and my understanding is that that is no longer there. I know that they never registered any employee, and I know that they never proceeded with an application, and therefore, whatever it was that might have been intended never happened. I don't know whether you are frolicking about. I'm very lenient, I suppose, in my office, but a lot of frolics is not my reactivity, I think.
Mr. Speaker, I mean, this is now starting to look like a Monty Python sketch. The one about the test, the dead parrot. It's a very dead parrot indeed. Now, I know it's a very dead parrot, but when I'm asking it, when it was alive, what was its purpose? Now, Mr. Speaker, he is the minister responsible. It's not an improper question. It's not an unreasonable question. He must have given the go-ahead to his civil servant to allow this incorporation of this company, for his civil servant to be shareholders of this company, for this company to be registered in his offices. What was the intention behind this company? Why the requisite of the honourable minister to provide me with the information that I am that we're seeking? It's a perfectly reasonable question.
Speaker, whatever might have been in the mind of those who thought of doing something, since if something didn't happen, I don't feel I have to give any answers as to what might have happened if it had been considered. It wasn't.
Let me go back a stage. Was the honourable minister involved in authorizing the use of this particular company for whatever use, he doesn't want to tell me the use or its purpose, was he involved in authorizing his civil servant to assist in the incorporation of this particular company?
No, Mr. Speaker, I don't require my authorization for each individual company that is incorporated. This one or another one.
But does he know what the purpose of this company was when it was first incorporated? Does he know that?
Discussed with me, and I have no reason to want to know.
But he doesn't know.
Oh, well, I don't know, but I don't care, Mr. Speaker.
Can you clarify an issue which I have in my mind now, and I would really seek his assistance in trying to clear the web somewhat. We have here a company which is registered at his office.
I honestly don't think that the Honourable Mr. Postino needs to go. I think we all know what it is that has happened. No, you don't need to, okay? Ask a parliamentary question by all means, but you don't need to give the background, because even I can understand fully what it's all about.
I said that, Mr. Speaker, and I take my advice. Right. As I understand it, the government was providing corporate services to a fixed
set of people. In other words, they were in their 50s, long-term unemployed. I think he also said involved in the construction industry, etc., etc. He has said that this particular company did not fit the bill. In other words, the owner of that particular company did not fit the bill. So can he tell me whether this service is being provided to people who do not fit into that criteria? That's a supplementary question.
We told him. I have great difficulty, much as I would like to help the honorable man, or is asking for my help. My problem in helping him is that the help I give him doesn't seem to take, because he keeps on asking me the same thing. I told him initially that one identifiable category of people were approached by the employment service and did not approach us on their initiative. So we went looking for them. And they are the people who have been long-term unemployed in their 50s, in the construction industry, which we have, this one is not one of them. I didn't say nobody that doesn't fit into this category has been helped with a company. I didn't say that. I said, this is the category that I can tell the honorable member is the one that I think is now accepted, but tomorrow that could change. So if you're asking me, I've already answered that this is not a company in that category. Right? So the fact that it's not in that category, it doesn't mean that all the 17 companies that have been identified by the honorable member, it's a figure that I'm taking as a value, I haven't actually counted them. But assuming that there are 17, but if there are more, well, I thought, look, I get that figure wrong a lot of times, and maybe wrong of the 17 as well, it's a figure. But apart from the ones that have identified, which I think are about 8 or 9, which are the ones that are really doing the work of the construction industry, there have been other companies that have been helped in our areas. They have come looking for us. So this is one that the approach is not initiated by the employment service.
Question 192, the Honorable J.J. Neto.
Mr. Speaker, can Cannon Street is a child who had an accident as a result of climbing onto the scaffold erected in the Laguna estate during the last few months, and so as a factor of inspection made an incident report setting out the circumstances in which the incident took place and why, and in so provide Cannon with a copy of the report.
Answer the Honourable Minister for Enterprise, Training, Employment and Health and Safety.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with 193 and 194.
Question 193.
Mr. Speaker. May I go back to the question about the leisure company? Just ask one supplementary of the honourable gentleman. It's information that I did not personally have, but it's been communicated to me. I think it is a relevant supplementary and important one. Mr. Speaker, I'll be correct if I'm wrong, but the information that we have on this side was that the application for a trade license related to the maintenance of children's parks in Gibraltar. Can the honourable gentleman tell me whether that is accurate?
Yes, if I didn't submit the application for a trade license, no. I'm neither responsible for what was put there. No, for its accuracy.
And he can confirm that he's not aware of any discussions of any kind between anybody in his department and the owner, whoever that may be, of this particular company. We don't know because the shareholder is a civil servant, so we don't know who stands behind those civil servants. He's not aware of any conversations between anybody in his department and the owners of that company in relation to maintenance of children's parks or anything else that this company was purporting to potentially engage in.
Well, I don't know what he was purporting to do or not purporting to do, and I certainly don't think I have the responsibility to come here and report conversations have taken place between members of my department and anybody else as if I was eavesdropping. I don't do that to myself.
Question 193, the Honourable Zelda Neto.
The figure, can you tell me stories of all the strategy erected and devoted since 2012 has been inspected and certified and found to be compliant with the Factory Act and its subsidiary legislation prior to the work commencing, and have not listed the names of the company or companies that were not compliant and the respective site or sites on which this happened?
Question 194.
Figure, can this government state if there have been any site or site in which scaffolding that have been inspected and certified after work commenced in 2012 are not inspected and certified at all, and in fact provide the names of the companies and sites involved?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Enterprise, Training, Employment and Health and Safety.
The government is aware that the child climbed onto a scaffolding in Laguna State, but the matter was not reported to the factory inspector. When the department became aware, an inspection was carried out by the factory inspector to confirm the safety of the scaffolding. All scaffoldings of which the inspectorate has received notification have been inspected and certified before work commenced, and none after work commenced or not at all.
I'm grateful to speak for that answer, but I didn't quite catch the ending part of the first question, 192, in where the Honourable Minister said that once they became aware, they actually went on strike. Has he proceeded to do an instant before to try and find the circumstances of what happened by your fact inspected?
Well, not because of what I said, but I think an incident reported that required an inspection and a report. I mean, it's like that when I became aware of it and it was brought to my knowledge, you know, by somebody, a member of the public or somebody else, that had been a child involved in climbing, I asked him to go and have a look just to be on the safe side of the safety requirement to check that everything was in order and that it wasn't that the child had been affected by a badly erected scaffolding. And they said that clearly that the scaffolding had been inspected initially when it was put up and certified as okay. And they went back and said anything had gone wrong, and they couldn't really find anything that could explain how the accident had happened. So it didn't work into any problem.
Question 195, the Honourable D. A. Seaton.
Well, Mr. Speaker, can the Chief Minister please provide details of the total cost of the future drug strategy to the task force since the 31st of March 2013, broken down by month?
Answer the Honourable Minister of Enterprise, Training, Employment and Health and Safety.
Mr. Speaker, since March 13, the average monthly cost of the training programme is £975,000. As was the case with its previous scheme, the expenditure covers payments to the individuals in the training program and operating costs. The persons covered are those employed by the employment training company, the construction training company, the graduate research and development company, and the supported employment company. In addition to the cost of materials used in training, which are charged to this item of expenditure, and the running cost of JIPDOC and the construction training center facility, payment for courses at Bleak House is also covered, and payment made in respect of ad hoc training, for example, the provision of training to obtain a bus driver and heavy goods vehicle driver licenses and plant operation qualifications, which are examples of some more training that has been going on. Registration fees payable to UK awarding bodies are also met from this expenditure for trainees that are taking part in the program.
A month, £975 million. Can you
£135,000 per month. By asking the, in relation to the future job strategy, he has widened that to include other areas which are not strictly the future job strategy. Does he have just a single future job strategy, a subdivision?
What he calls the future job strategy is the label provided to the program of training in the election campaign. I mean, we don't have anything now called a future job strategy. What we have is all the training is financed from one head of expenditure, which is the head of expenditure that is about, I think we put it in this year's budget, 11.7 million. And that covers GIPDOC, the construction training center, all the materials, the wages of the people there, the fees for the city and guild, which we have to pay to the United Kingdom, and also some programs that we started running recently, where, as a result, for example, of having a situation where we could not provide people with driving licenses for having a good vehicle, or people with driving licenses for buses, we've actually moved away from the traditional parameters that we are training people and placing them with somebody, and we told people who are unemployed that we would keep them on the unemployment register, but pay for their training for them to be able to get new skills and qualifications, which makes it easier for us to find them a job. That is also being funded from this vote, and that is being funded for people who are, in effect, continuing unemployed and not trainees. So we are funding all the cost of all the people in the four companies that are doing trainees, which includes the support of employment, which are permanent employees, and the people that sometimes, somebody, for example, we've got some people who are doing hairdressing. They are not employed by us as trainees hairdressers, but we are meeting the cost of the tuition of the hairdressing, which is an initiative of somebody from the industry that came to us and said, I would be happy to take on people and train them if you meet the cost. And all that stuff is also coming out of there.
Does he have a breakdown in relation to this? For example, does he have a breakdown as to how much the wages is in relation to this figure, the wages component in relation to this figure of 975 million?
That probably the labor cost of a trainee is of the order of 600,000 or 700,000 out of that, which would include the employer's social insurance contributions.
Mr. Speaker, that's in relation, just to be absolutely clear, that's in relation to those employees of the companies which form part of the label we described earlier, the future job strategy. You know, there's three or four companies, UCCL and CCCL. Yeah? Mr. Speaker, this is referred to some individuals who were currently registered unemployed, were being, in effect, paid by the government of an income, and but weren't following the SAS scheme procedure, whereby it would be posted with an employer. Can you also confirm that are those individuals are they exclusively within the driver category, which I think you referred to?
They're not being paid an income. What I said was not that they were being paid, but they're not being paid. So they're registered unemployed, they're getting the unemployment benefit, they continue to be offered jobs, but they're being given the opportunity of attending courses. And what we are doing is paying the tuition. So for example, the bus driver and the heavy goods vehicle is costing us £50 an hour for the training. But this is being paid to the company that is providing the training, that puts the bus and the driver and the fuel and so on. £50 an hour. Right? But the guys that are being trained and then go and get a license, we pay for the cost of the license. We people haven't, you know, they're on the go. So we pay for them to be trained, we pay for the cost of the license, and that it means, of course, that we are now able, we put something like 20 through this system. The advantage is now that we are now able, people who are driving licenses but didn't have only a BA license kind of thing. Now, we are now able to, when a vacancy comes up, we are now able to offer candidates with the necessary qualifications to be able to do the job. And we've been able to employ some of them in as coach drivers for the tourist industry, and we've been able to employ some of them as truck drivers in the construction industry.
Mr. Speaker, can you confirm, my memory is a bit hazy on this issue. Can you confirm whether this is part of the announcement that the Minister for Traffic, I think, made at the time when I was responsible, had that sort of responsibility? Is that not the same thing?
Not to my knowledge, frankly. This is something that was, I mean, in some of these cases, there are a number of these things going on. And in fact, the initiative has come from the training provider. That is, somebody came to us and said, look, it's very difficult to find local people to when we want to hire people for coach tours. And it's difficult to find people when we want people to you know, I mean, there's an upsurge in demand now for people to drive trucks because it's a lot of construction work. And we've got people unemployed, we are pressing people in the construction industry to take them on, and so somebody came along and said, well, look, I am prepared for £50 an hour to train people and take them through and get them qualified. And then, once they're qualified, if they're still unemployed, as soon as I've got a job, I'll offer them a job. And as a result of that, it wasn't our idea, it was my idea. It was something, an idea put to me, which I welcome, and therefore we invest a few £1,000 in this kind of training, you know. I mean, this is not big money, because there are thousands of people involved, there's only 20 or 30, but we're doing this in this area, we're doing it in hairdressing, and there are three or four activities of this kind, where in a sense what we're doing is upskilling the people that are registered and employed, and the basic departure from what we were doing before is that they continue to be unemployed, they don't get paid, and they continue to be available for work. And if, for example, the guy that is doing the training for truck driver, a vacancy comes in for a foreman, and he wants to do a foreman job, then we abandon the post, there's no penalty in that year job. So, effectively, all the people who are doing this kind of thing are included in the unemployment figures that I provide the Honourable Member with.
Question 196, the Honourable G. A. Beaton.
Can the Chief Minister please provide details of the value of the Gibraltar Savings Bank debentures as at the 31st of January 2014?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Enterprise, Training, Employment and Health and Safety.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question with question 197 to 199.
Question 197.
Will the Chief Minister please give a breakdown by debenture issue of that part of the aggregate public debt that comprises government debentures as at the 31st of December 2013 and as of the 31st of January 2014?
Question 198.
Can the Chief Minister please state what was 1. The gross public debt, 2. Cash reserves, and 3. The net public debt as at the 31st of December 2013 and the 31st of January 2014.
Question 199.
Can the Chief Minister please give a breakdown by bank and amount of that part of the aggregate public debt which comprises bank debt as of the 31st of December 2013 and 31st of January 2014?
answer the Honourable the Minister for Enterprise, Training, Employment and Health and Safety.
Speaker, the value of Gibraltar Savings Bank debentures by maturity date, I think that's the 1st of January 2014, was 1 month, 23,390,700 pounds. 2015 debentures, that's a maturity year, 34,165,200 pounds. 2016 debentures, 23,076,600 pounds. 2017 debentures, 86,241,500 pounds. 2018 debentures, 165,074,000 pounds. 2019 debentures, 10,594,400 pounds. Other debentures, 6,171,623 pounds. Government debentures by maturity date were as the 31st of December 2013, 2013 debentures, 819,300 pounds. 2017 debentures, 67,917,600 pounds. 1 month notice, 89,057,000 pounds. On the 31st of January 2014, the figure was 2017 debentures, 67,913,000 pounds, 800 pounds. And 1 month notice, 88,440,800 pounds. The 2013 debenture obviously was repaid before January. As at the end of December 13, the gross debt was 457 million, the cash reserves were 222 million, and the net debt was 235 million. At the end of January, the gross debt was 456 million, the cash reserves 223 million, and the net debt 233 million. The aggregate public debt at the 31st of December and the 31st of January included bank loans of 400 million. These bank loans in both months were 150 million from Barclays Bank and 50 million from Northwest Offshore Limited.
Question 200, the Honourable G. A. Seaton.
Can the Chief of Police provide the total net increase in numbers of personnel in the public service since he was elected into office, broken down by reference to the civil service, the Gibraltar Development Corporation, government-owned companies, and public authorities?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Enterprise, Training, Employment and Health and Safety.
Mr. Speaker, the net increase between the 31st of December 2011 and the 31st of December 2013 is as follows. Civil Service, 123. GDC, 28. Government agencies and companies, 654.
Mr.
Speaker, does the 654 include future job strategy trainees within that figure 654, or is he just giving me effectively the permanent increase in the public service in relation to these two areas, government-owned companies and public authorities?
It includes everybody who was paid that month from any government company, and therefore it includes the four training companies. And the figure is the honourable member will remember, because it used to be done before, is what the statistics office produces every quarter, which shows the people who got paid at the end of that month.
Question 201, the Honourable DJ Bacino.
Can the Minister with responsibility for aviation to provide details since he came to office of all those individuals other than the Chief Minister who have benefited from not having to pass through customs or immigration control when boarding or disembarking from a flight at Gibraltar Airport, and have had use of an official car of the Gibraltar government to include the G1?
Answer the Honourable the Deputy Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I will now hand over the other member of schedule concerning the information in question.
May I now ask supplementary whilst my learned and John is a friend analyzing schedule? The answer he's given me, and effectively I've done the total here, is the total increase in the public service of 805 employees in the public service from when they got elected to date. That's the answer that he has given me. Now, I note that earlier on, he answered in relation to one of the questions that my honourable friend Mr. Rossino asked about the number of people employed in the public and the private sector. He said that in the public sector, the number was 6,293. Now we're looking at the employment survey, and the employment survey indicates that for 2011, there were 4,574 people in the public service and the public sector, and in 2012, 4,991. From the figures that you provided, Mr. Bofino, it appears that there has been a larger increase in the public service than in the answer you provided me today. Now, I don't know, that may be explainable. I'm asking him, can he explain the differences in the numbers?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, the answer and the explanation is a very simple one. The figures are drawn from different sources. The employment survey, is the return produced by employers to put down who they employ. And the figure that is asked me today, the figure of the employment survey is only available for 1 month a year, the month of October. The figure that I've given him is the most recent figure on the computer in the ETB. And to give him an indication of why such discrepancies arise, for example, the people who were employed during the summer, who had come out from university and were working during the summer season as beekeepers and lifesavers and all those who were there until September and then they went back to the university, the department forgot to inform the ETB that they were no longer there until January, so they will have been included in December. If you look back at the questions that I used to put, and if I remind them of that, I often point it out to the government of the day that there were four different sources of information and four different figures. So if you ask a social insurance, you get one figure, you get it from the employment survey, you get another one. If you ask the department, you get a different one, and if you get the computer in the ETB, you probably have the least accurate of the four. And that is because there's no guarantee. I mean, we've been trying hard for the last 2 years to reduce that gap, that discrepancy between one figure and the other. And we are now in the process of tracking down 150 employers who may no longer exist, but have never bothered to tell anybody that they don't exist, and therefore the records remain in the employment service, and that may be 200 or 300 people. But there is a serious problem, and I think until we start effectively finding people for failing to inform the department when somebody is no longer working, I mean, it's easier to enforce the illegal labor thing where they've got somebody working and they don't tell them. But it's more difficult to enforce when the guy just disappears and nobody tells them. And the answer is that, subject to what I've said on a number of occasions about the lack of accuracy of the employment service, I think the honorable member should take the figure that I've given today with a pinch of salt, but it's a figure that I have.
Yes, I mean, I could understand all that. If I were asking questions about the private sector, but we're talking about the public sector. And we think that the figures in terms of increases in the public sector would be far more accurate than the private sector. Mm. I mean, employers, the public sector, the employers are government-owned companies, government authorities, government departments, the BBC. And if one looks at the employment survey, one sees that there is an increase from 2011 of 4,574 employees in the public service to 4,991 in 2012, an increase of 9.1%. That's the figures that his department produced. Today, there is a huge jump from there in 2012 to 6,393. That's a significant increase in the public service. Now, I had asked for a question about the net increase in the public service since they got into office in December. And the answer is 805. That's the answer, 805 today. But if you look at the employment survey, the increase, in accordance with the answer that he provided Mr. Bottino, is of the order of 1,400 in 2012 to today. Which of the two represents a more accurate picture as to the increase in the public service? The figures in the employment survey, which is now supplemented today, or this answer that he provided to me, which appears to indicate that there's 805 net increase in the public service since they got into office?
The most accurate figure is the one I provided him today because that is the pinnacle, that is the rate. The one produced by the statistics office, the one that says that there were 123 more people in the civil service, the one I just given him, is the pinnacle. So at the end of December 11, X number of people were paid. And 2 years later, why people were paid. And the difference between the S and the Y is the 805 that is. So we had 805 people more being paid out of public funds in December 13 as opposed to December 11. And 450 of those would be the trainees. In terms of the people in the database, I agree with the honourable member that the records of the public sector ought to be better than the records of the private sector. But I can tell him that when I got there, I discovered that they had people who had left years ago from the health authority, and nobody had bothered to terminate the contract and send it to B2B. And we did an exercise about 6 months ago where we took the figure in the health authority might be something like 800 in the estimate, the figure in the employment service was 1,200. And we took about 400 people out, some of whom were dead and buried. And it's still not being cleaned up. And it's a mammoth task of people checking and inputting and correcting things. And if you look back at the answers that they provided me with, when I asked him a question, he will find that in fact the gap is smaller, maybe by something like 600 or 700, which is as much as I've been able to whittle it down by checking. But it means checking every single employer in the Gibraltar and tracing every single department. And I think, frankly, it's simply not on that government departments themselves should be scaled up in complying with the law and informing the employment service of the terminations of the employees and not. But there are people who retired for years and nobody had told you. I mean, indeed, at one stage when I started chasing people up on this, I was told by I think it was like in Human Resources or in the Chief Secretary's office, that they thought that the civil service wouldn't have to comply with me. And I told the director that there was no exemption for account. But civil service, you know, the idea was that because civil servants get a letter of appointment, they didn't have to fill up a termination of employment form and send it to B2B. And that apparently had been going on for years, and nobody had challenged it previously. But at the answer is that I would expect that the figure that I've given him earlier today, which is what I got from somebody pushing the button in the computer and saying what's the number, and that's the number that's come out, and we can actually produce the 6,000 names, and then we can go and see if those people are still alive, you know? But the reality of it is that we are trying to reduce the inaccuracy in the system by chasing people up in the departments and by chasing private sector employers. And fairly soon, I'm going to be announcing that we're going to start finding people in this world, believe, whether they're in the public or the private.
And it seems very odd to me, I have to say, when the Honourable Gentleman gave these figures, because on a quick calculation, what he indicated was that the total labour force in Gibraltar, public and private sector, was in the order of over 26,000. And that seemed to me to be out by about 2,000-3,000. So the figures that he's provided, Mr. Rossino, really are taken from the computer. They're not the public service I'm talking about. They're not payroll. But presumably, if we were to ask next time round, what is the total number of people on the payroll in the public service? Those figures are available from the Treasury in the same way as he actually given me the net increase of in the public service from those figures in answer to my question.
Right. That calculation is done on a quarterly basis. And it's done on a quarterly basis by the statistics, and it used to be provided for the previous government, and it's always been provided. Right? So that quarterly headcount. The different sources count things in a different way. So, for example, in the case of the figures that are given him today,
it is people who are actually in the month of December receiving a salary at the end of the month. But it would include, for example, people who are working a supply because somebody's on maternity leave. So, you know, it's the most accurate in the sense that if you get paid, you're there. And if you didn't get paid, you're not there. So if somebody's on unpaid leave, you wouldn't be there. The others are the return from employers is what the employer puts on in the form. And the return from the employment service is what somebody put there sometime in the past and either tell it to cancel or even that, you know, we had a situation where I've mentioned it to the normal member before. Look, the 4 years, I know that they think that I've got a deal for Mr. Montiel, but I don't. But I have mentioned before that the 4 years that Mr. Montiel was actually the Minister for Employment responsible for the accuracy of this, he appeared as not being in government and being in the GDC in mid-house. It was hardly an assistant to say to anybody, I'm going to fine you for not notifying me when he had failed to notify his own termination in this house. And then I was sitting in the office, I was his name in the computer saying he wasn't there, but there was a sibling somewhere in this house monitoring the operation. Well, I have to say, even Mr. Speaker was still shown as being in the GDC when I started checking the record. So,
in October 2012, I remember making a return to the board signifying that I was terminating employment at the end of October.
Well, in December 11, you were still there, Mr. Speaker.
Question.
Mr. Speaker, I've got a supplementary in relation to question 201. Mr. Speaker, I've had some time to look at the schedule and it very helpfully sets out what is the security screening policy of the Gibraltar Civil Aviation Security Program. Now, it's dated, that particular program is dated 2014. Can you honourable Deputy Minister, can you honourable Deputy Minister tell me whether what the differences are between the 2014 policy and the policy we deserve before that? There was a change to the original program of 2010 when in April 2011, when the Honourable Members were in government, they added the spouse of the Chief Minister and the spouse of the Governor to the people who are exempt. There was another change in 2012 when the Civil Aviation Security Regulator was authorised to authorise ad hoc exemptions at the request of the Minister for Civil Aviation, and that was a change which basically reflected the practice which had been set in place since 2010. And then, in addition to that, in 2012, the police protection officers undertaking escorting duty were also included in this. Mr. Speaker, he mentioned the title which was mentioned as part of the government of Gibraltar. Presumably, what was also added to it was the salary and children accompanying any of the above individuals, or was that something that must be the case? It's the final bullet point in section B. The Honourable Deputy Minister referred to the third that referred to, but there's also a final one, which refers to, and it's just logically followed.
titles and a company person is listed in the section.
Mr. Speaker, we haven't, the only thing that they may be keeping were those into family control, where of course in policy and where the procedure, to the procedure. But everything else they're getting from the policy, including the kingdom. So it must be done in the government.
Speaker, I think it's the escorting policemen, because we have the royal visit, I think, in that year. There were 14 policemen escorting members of the royal family. The Chief Minister and the Governor do not travel through the air terminal, or at least never have, or maybe a person in the world might have to, but we've never travelled with escorting policemen through the air terminal. So it's specifically done to deal with those who were escorting the royal family members who came through the border. Everything else, every single aspect of the procedure is exactly set down by them when they were in administration, and the practice which they built up when they were in administration.
Question 202, the Honourable J.J. Mitchell.
Speaker, can the government state the number of Catholics who have been arrested since 2012 to date, stating which ones are government private and which ones are private ones?
Answer, the Honourable the Deputy Chief Minister.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, I will answer the question together with question 203.
Question 203.
Mr. Speaker, can the government state the date and location of every scaffold to have been erected since 2012, either in government projects or private ones, the date in which the scaffold was dismantled, the projects that are still ongoing, and the name of the company erecting the scaffold, and for what project?
Answer, the Honourable Deputy Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I will now hand the Honourable Member a statement concerning the information request.
Again, this is a very long study. Maybe 6 pages. May I suggest we go on to question 204, the Honourable Mr. Senator?
Question 204, the Honourable J.J. Mitchell.
Speaker, can the government state the money spent for government projects on scaffolding since 2012, stating to which company and whether the payments are for completed work or for ongoing projects?
Answer, the Honourable the Deputy Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the cost of scaffolding for the project is in the name not identified as a separate item in the contract. Scaffolding is included as part of the general contract preliminary, and its cost cannot therefore be easily identified. It is therefore not possible to provide information for all government projects since 2012. The information which is available is provided in the table which you have in the room.
We could ask the Deputy Chief Minister, if we got to the last question, 2004, I think I understood, probably to be corrected, that he couldn't give me the cost of the project because he couldn't disaggregate the amount of payment to the capital from the overall cost of the particular project. But is it not the case, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that the fee, when a particular company is about to put a scaffold up, they have to seek permission from building control department. And, you know, they have the form which they say, well, you know, for such and such a day, we're going to start erecting the scaffold in such a place, and go and by such and such a day. And according to the time that the scaffold is going to be up, then a schedule of rates goes towards the payment of a scaffold for the duration of the scaffold being erected at that particular site. Is that not the case?
that scaffolding is not something that comes across my desk very often, and the reason I've complied with this is because it's different government departments that are all involved, and some of them have to deal with their own projects. But the information which is available in relation to that particular what is requested, which is the cost of the scaffolding, in the project that we have, is what I supplied to them. The information which you, what you referred to earlier, I think is the revenue generation of the government from scaffolding, not the cost of scaffolding for the project. So they're two different things.
So the information with regard to how much is charged for scaffolding, that can be provided. And that can be provided because information is gathered at the utility control department. Is that correct?
Yes, you think about it. It's the revenue the government generates from that, and not what is charged by the scaffolding company to the person or the company carrying out the project. Rather, they're two different things.
Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful for the Deputy Minister's attempt at clarifying this. Is it correct to assume that where you have the particularization of open GOP problem, that given that you have that particular information, you may at some point be able to determine what the cost of that specific project listed as an open GOP project might be?
They see that we can determine the revenue the government receives from scaffolding, which is put up out all available training in relation to building control here. That we have available and that we can spread, but that's not where the amendment is at. The information we've compiled in that is what the cost is of scaffolding in relation to a project, which is an expense and not a revenue.
And the Honourable Deputy is saying that it is impossible to ascertain the cost to government of the scaffolding. It's not that it is difficult or perhaps not the most practical task, but impossible to secure information?
Certainly, it's impossible to obtain in relation to a number of projects that the scaffolding sometimes included in the cost. It's not broken down as a separate item. But in those projects where it is broken down as a separate item, we will provide that to an amendment in one of the schedules.
Peter, is he saying that in relation to this schedule is the schedule of total scaffolding, the large one, the very long one, is the schedule that includes a list of all scaffolding arrested, with effectively in government projects, whether it's a contract with the government, presumably with a government-owned company. I wonder if the total schedule that provides the cost to the government. And what is he suggesting, that anything that's not listed in this short schedule, it's because the cost of the scaffolding is subsumed within the cost of the contract?
I see that is correct. It's not broken down item one.
In the long schedule, if we take number 78 as an example, the capital minerals of a recommendant create a road, and if Mr. Gagay analyzes down the growth of projects of just the property, I don't think it's a government property. Can the minister imagine how we can have for the rest what I understand to be a private entity, and yet it's been listed as a government project? And in order to take and the same would probably apply to number 97, where the Mary the Crown may speak, if I take it to be the cathedral, where again it's a government project, and I don't think it's a government owned kingdom.
Mr. Speaker, there was some sort of letter of comment, although these appear to be March to April 2013, I think are probably part of the work undertaken there by the previous administration. Not by this administration, and that may simply be a tidying up or
a fixing in respect of that, but, and that building arises is not a government building, but it appears, I can't say more than that at this stage, that all of the work and all of the extension done at that school was a government project, although it's not a government school and it's not a government building, but they were the ones who were in power when it was done. I know no more about it.
That's because of all that, that's not a confirmation that it was a government project, despite the property being a private one. The same goes for number 97, which is, you know, the start date of September 2013, and it's still ongoing. So, I mean, that will be going on for, you know, 4 or 5 months or something, and the community can take some light on that one as well.
And speaking of system, that is work done to the particular scenario with grounds which the government has agreed to subsidize.
That's where I understand it. In this column, may I ask the Deputy Chief Minister, this particular column, which indicates private, or Her Majesty's government, and what's the difference between the two? It's dealing with what? A private project in relation to which the government has some involvement? Because I wouldn't expect the government to be answering questions for which it is not responsible in this house. I mean, it's a private project. Can you explain that?
So, the member asked in relation to government projects or private projects, that was the question, and in relation to scaffolding which are gone up, which is a building concern matter. So, in that sense, the government is involved.
And with that, we come to the end of oral questions. Now we go on to written questions. The Honourable Retief Minister.
I have the honour to table the answers to written questions W25 to W35 of 2014.
I know we've moved on to written questions, but I've just spotted in the long study that the Honourable Deputy Chief Minister gave me, item 24, on the last column, there's nothing at all indicating whether it's a government project or a private copy. Is that an error, you know, in the printing or something?
Looking at the scaffold location, it looks to be a private project, but I can say that the person without handling it for anything.
Mr.
Speaker, I have the honour to move that the House will now adjourn to Friday, the 21st of February 2014 at 10:30 a.m.
I now put the question which the House will now adjourn to Friday, the 21st of February at 10:30 a.m. Those in favour? As again, carried. The House will now adjourn to Friday, the 21st of February at 10:30 a.m.